you'll recall that in connection with the connections between the Kennedy assassination and Watergate, I read some excerpts from volume 5 of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission testimony and exhibits that had some rather intriguing remarks by Jack Ruby. Now, Jack has been cited as one of the two lone nuts of the Kennedy assassination, and he had a lot of things to say during the course of his incarceration before he died of a berry aneurysm at the base of the brain. And generally, Jack Ruby has been regarded as sort of a screwball. As in, you know, the official version is that he was a nut, that he suffered from psychomotor epilepsy, and that the pressure of the event caused a brief psychomotor epileptic episode of undefined nature, which caused him to kill Lee Harvey Oswald with a single shot. Nipper's about to read you some sections of a letter that Jack Ruby wrote while he was in prison, and this letter, among other things, has been cited as reasons why Jack was crazy.
Okay, now the letter that follows, and this is being read from a book called, and it's not really a book, it's almost more of a magazine-type situation. It's called In the Shadow of Dallas, a primer on the assassination of President Kennedy. This was published by the editors of Ramparts magazine, who were among the leading and analysts in terms of getting the assassination researchers and giving them space to pursue these things in the period following the Warren Commission's report. And so Ramparts gave a lot of these people their first shot in print on the Kennedy assassination. Many of them were already writers or journalists or whatever the case may be. But a lot of magazines wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole because of the questions that they called up that put a lot of our political institutions in a bad light. Ramparts writes in their introduction to this letter that the letter that which follows is one of two unsigned letters handwritten in pencil on slips from a memo pad, confiscated by one of Ruby's guards and subsequently smuggled from the jail. They were sold at auction in the Astor Gallery in New York on January 31st, 1966, by Charles Hamilton, a reputable autograph dealer who vouched for their authenticity. The purchaser of this one was Texas editor Penn Jones, Jr., author of the book Forgive My Grief. He paid $950. Ruby's younger brother, Sam, immediately contacted Jones and confirmed that Ruby had admitted writing the letter. Okay? They also add, with Jones's permission, we are publishing the entire letter, which was 33 pages in its original handwritten form. We're not going to be reading the whole letter tonight. This is its exclusive publication, and it is presented as Ruby wrote it, without correcting his errors in spelling, grammar, or punctuation, without attempting to clarify its ambiguities, et cetera, et cetera. It will be remembered that Ruby never went beyond the eighth grade in school. Okay, so here is Jack Ruby's letter, or at least portions thereof. John, you must believe what I am about to write to you. And after you have read the contents, try to remember everything, and then destroy same. And whatever you do, don't take anyone in your confidence, except the names of the people that I will enclose here. And these, try to remember them by going over their names constantly until you are sure that you will remember them. First, you must realize that the people here want everyone to think I am crazy. So if what I know is actually, then no one will believe me because of my supposed insanity. Now, I know that my time is running out, and that the most that I'll be here will be 2 or 3 days more, and they plan doing away with me. Don't let the smiles, etc., of the guards fool you. Supposing I prove to be right about not being here much longer, then you will have to believe everything else I'm going to tell you. You have watched my behavior and my actions for some time now, and certainly you have come to the conclusion that I am normal. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been as kind to me as you have been. So you must make up your mind as to what you think of me. If you have up to now thought of me as a nice person and a very sincere person, then you must believe me that I know what is taking place. And so please, with all my heart, you must believe me, because I am counting on you to save this country a lot of bloodshed. As soon as you get out, you must read Texas Looks at Lyndon, and it may open your eyes to a lot of things. This man is a Nazi in the worst order. For over a year now, they have been doing away with my people. Of course, you don't read about these things in the paper. They have means and ways of keeping it secret. But supposing you find out when you are released that all of the Jews have been done away with, and after telling you so far in advance, which proves that I must have some knowledge of what is going on. The reason for this lengthy explanation is that I want you to have faith in me, and perhaps you can be of some use in helping to save a lot of other people.
Interrupting briefly, Jack Ruby was Jewish.
Yes, Jack Ruby was short for Rubenstein, I believe.
Right.
Okay, skipping along through the letter, it says, now, Ruby writes, here is the plan. Someone must get to England and France and Israel and tell the right people what has happened to the Jews so they can prepare themselves from the same kind of thing happening here. They will know that there's only one kind of people that would do such a thing. That would have to be the Nazis. And who is in power in this country right now? And that is who is in power in this country right now. If they would kill a man like Jonas Salk, the man responsible for the cure of infantile paralysis, then there it must be true what I'm telling you. That is why the president don't want any out of the country traveling, because he expects to invade those countries over there. The only countries which will be safe are the former Axis countries, Egypt, Germany, Japan, and Italy. Brazil already has been overthrown. The democratic people of Germany are also going to be slaughtered. Explain this all to blank. He re-returned from Russia. Of both evils between Russia and the Nazis, you have the best in choosing Russia. Johnson is going to try to have an all-out war with Russia, and when that happens, Johnson and his cohorts will be on the sidelines where they won't get hurt, while the Americans may get wiped out. The only way this can be avoided is that if Russia would be informed as to who the real enemies are, and in that way they won't be tricked into starting a war with the U.S. The war can be avoided this way, because the Russians will tell Johnson that they won't bomb the U.S., but only Brazil, Germany, Egypt, and then in parentheses, who is only faking at this time to be an ally of Russia, don't believe it. Japan also is in on the deal, but the old warlords are going to come back. South America is also full of these Nazis. England, France, Sweden, and all the other countries who were our allies must be warned, and they must be told who is the worst of the two. They have got to try to make up with the Russians. Explain all of this to blank. Round up all my friends that I mentioned here, and when they all get together, and they have known me for so many years and watched my actions and would swear for me that I couldn't be anything else but a 100% American, it wouldn't to convince them that I had been framed. And if those people were so determined to frame me, then you must be convinced that they had an ulterior motive for doing same. There is only one kind of people that would go to such extremes, and that would be the master race, who want to make slaves of the rest of the world. Johnson is only faking his friendship for the colored race. Don't believe it. That was his strategy to win the election. He also put a lot of Jews in top office positions, just to make people believe he was a friend of the Jews. He put Sheldon Cohen to head the Internal Revenue. He knew he was going to get rid of him very shortly. They are going to come out with a story that it was the Minutemen who killed the Jews. Don't you believe that? They are using that to cover up for the Nazis. One more thing. Isn't it strange that Oswald, who hasn't worked a lick most of life, should be fortunate enough to get a job at the book building 2 weeks before the president himself didn't know as to when he was to visit Dallas? Now, where would a jerk like Oswald get the information that the president was coming to Dallas? One person could have had that information, and that man was Johnson, who knew weeks in advance as to what was going to happen, because he is the one who was going to arrange the trip for president. This had been planned long before the president himself knew about, so you figure that one out. The only one who gained by the shooting of the president was Johnson, and he was in a car in the rear, and safe when the shooting took place. What would the Russians, Castro, or anyone else have to gain by eliminating the president? If Johnson was so heartbroken over Kennedy, why didn't he do something for Robert Kennedy? All he did was snub him. Also, look another friend, blank, who owns the blank in Dallas. Bring these facts up to blank, that I had been to the Western Union to send money to the showgirl in Fort Worth. That was at 11:17 a.m. Sunday, which was stamped on the receipt. And at a little before 11:21 a.m., I shot Oswald, and it took just that amount of time to walk the distance from the Western Union to the bottom of the ramp. Tell them to check the distance and to time it. It is right on the fraction of a second. I could never have timed it that close and been in on a conspiracy. Also, if I in on something, why would I have accepted a phone call at 10:50 at my apartment from a girl? A man that had planned something that Sunday morning don't accept phone calls. Try and remember all of this also, blank. He knows me very well. By Jack Ruby. Now, a couple of things. Just the most obvious thing, okay, not even getting into the Nazis, which we're going to get into and we're going to talk about in some more depth. The very fact that Jack Ruby has been painted as a man who either, one, had a sudden psychoneural epilepsy, forcing him to accidentally pull the trigger on the gun in a moment of passion, or two, that he was a man who merely wanted to stop the president's grieving widow from having come back to Dallas, stacked up against his speech in the jail cell, which you will remember Dave read last week, where he was literally begging Earl Warren to take him to Washington and give him a polygraph test, And this letter here, in which he is pleading for this friend of his to get this information out that some kind of a Nazi conspiracy is going on, and that he fears that his people, the Jews, are going to be wiped out, etc., etc. At the very least, even the most credulous of you out there, incredulous out there, I think would have real difficulty in reconciling this Jack Ruby, who we have given you two examples of his actual words at the time, against the man that the Warren Commission has offered up as being somehow the garrulous nightclub keeper who just wanted to save the widow a lot of grief.
Now, of course, the things that Ruby was saying, the United States should make up with Russia, in essence, he was sort of advocating a reformation of the World War II alliance between Britain, France, the United States, Russia, and so forth. And that letter has often been cited as proof positive that Ruby was three sheets to the wind, basically, that he was crazy as a loon, imagine suggesting that Lyndon Johnson was a Nazi, or that the Nazis were running the United States in 1963. Pretty crazy, huh? Well, that's what we're going to be examining tonight. How crazy is that? Now, if that sounds a little wild to you, hang on to your hats. I'm going to read you a short section here. This is from a book that we've used a lot on this program and is featured on other broadcasts on this station as well. It's called The Assassinations, and it's subtitled Dallas and Beyond, edited by three men, Peter Dale Scott, S-C-O-T-T, UCal Berkeley professor, a man named Paul L. Hoke, H-O-C-H, and Russell Stettler, S-T-E-T-L-E-R. Published in softcover by the Vintage Press in 1976. I'm going to read you a couple of sentences here from an essay by one of the editors, Paul L. Hoke, entitled CI Activities and the Warren Commission. And what Hoke is talking about here are the techniques used by the CIA to defame one of the early critics of the Warren Report, a German immigrant named Joachim Josten, last name J-O-E-S-T-E-N, usually called Joe Josten. Okay, from Paul L. Hoke's CIA Activities and the Warren Commission. The extent of CIA efforts to disseminate derogatory information about the critics should be examined. The agency did give the Warren Commission a 1937 Gestapo memo on Joachim Josten, the author of one of the first critical books on the assassination. Information that Josten had been a member of the German Communist Party, taken from the same memo, was later introduced into the congressional record in a report allegedly written by the CIA, which claimed that his criticism of the Warren Report was part of a, quote, communist bloc defamation campaign, unquote. Okay, so here we see the CIA not only relying upon the Gestapo, a Gestapo memo in order to criticize a Warren Commission critic, but then reading portions of that same memo into the congressional record. Pretty crazy, huh? Boy, that nut Jack Ruby. Listen to this. Again, reading a short section here from a book called Documents. This is, as its name implied, a compendium of declassified FBI and CIA memoranda. It was authored by Christy Macy, M-A-C-Y, and Susan Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N. And in this book, Documents, there is a section, here we go, got it, an excerpt from a CIA document entitled Document 1035-960. Again, 1035-960. It was issued in 1966. And it says here it was reviewed and released under the Freedom of Information Act in 1976. Oh, by the way, this book, Documents, edited by Christy Macy and Susan Kaplan, published in softcover by Penguin Books, copyrighted 1980. And I'm not going to read you all of Document 1035-60. It's dated, by the way, the actual date is April 1st, 1967. But I'm going to read you paragraph 4A. From CIA document 1035-60. It reads as follows. No significant new evidence. Oh, by the way, this document, before getting into it, this document is a memorandum to all CIA station chiefs on how to combat Warren Commission critics. In other words, how to defend the Warren Commission. Okay, reading again from paragraph 4A of 1035-60, April 1st, 67. No significant new evidence has emerged which the commission did not consider. The assassination is sometimes compared, e.g. by Joachim Josten and Bertrand Russell, with the Dreyfus case. However, unlike that case, the attacks on the Warren Commission have produced no new evidence, no new culprits have been convincingly identified, and there is no agreement among the critics. A better parallel, though an imperfect one, might be with the Reichstag fire of 1933, which some competent historians, Fritz Tobias, A.J.P. Taylor, and D.C. Watt, now believe was set by von der Lubbe on his own initiative without acting for either Nazis or communists. The Nazis tried to pin the blame on the communists, but the latter have been much more successful in convincing the world that the Nazis were to blame. Okay, now, what this basically is talking about here, of course, is the Reichstag fire in which the Nazis, not Martinus von der Lubbe, last name, by the way, V-A-N-D-E-R-L-U-B-B-E, in which the Nazis burned down the German parliament, the Reichstag building, blamed it on the communists, and used that as an excuse to impose dictatorial laws suspending traditional German liberties. And this, of course, was the mechanical device by which the Nazis assumed their total control over German society. Now, the Reichstag fire, I've never heard, I'm not familiar with the work of Messrs. Tobias Taylor and Watt. I've read a fair amount about World War II, and I've never heard anyone suggest that the Reichstag fire was anything but the Nazi provocation that it is attributed, that it has generally been labeled. The Reichstag fire was supposedly, according to Nazis, set by Martinus von der Lubbe, who was legally blind and legally insane, and according to John Gunther in his book Inside Europe 1937, was, quote, thrown out of the Dutch Communist Party for being the useless fellow that he was, unquote. And here we have to the Reichstag fire itself, Reichsmarshal Hermann Göring, head of the German Air Force, had a house right next door to the Reichstag. A tunnel adjoined that building, and he appeared on the Reichstag steps as the flames were licking up in earnest, and, you know, denounced the communists and so forth. And then there was a very famous trial in which the Nazis were eloquently and thoroughly put down, but it did not in any way affect the verdict that Martinus von der Lubbe, the legally blind and legally insane lone nut, set the fire. Now, the scary part about this memo is that basically we have here an endorsement of the Nazi view of history from an official American government document. In other words, here it's saying that basically von der Lubbe was a lone nut, but that the communists have been very successful in defaming the poor Nazis.
And not only do we have an American government intelligence official endorsing the Nazi view of history, but that they are using that Nazi view of history to in turn turn around and derogate the critics of the Warren Commission. So this is what we're seeing when we're talking about misinformation. We're not only talking about very subtle misinformation, we're literally talking about things like Nazi propaganda and Gestapo memos being used to derogate critics of the Warren Commission, and that goes a step beyond some of the other things that we've talked about.
Now, of course, Jack Ruby, maybe he doesn't look quite so silly now, saying the Nazis are in control of our government. Now, it may be a source of puzzlement to many people as to why we see these Nazi viewpoints, in essence, being disseminated by the CIA. Recall that a 1937 Gestapo memo was used by CIA to defame Joachim Joosten, Joe Joosten, and then a declassified CIA memorandum says, oh, no sweat, if you want to put down the Warren Commission, critics point out that it was the work of a lone nut, just like the Reichstag fire, although the commies have been very successful in defaming and pinning that on the Nazis. Now, basically, this endorsement of the Nazi viewpoint should not come as, on the part of the CIA, should not come as much of a shock as it may to some of you. There is a very, very important chapter in American history and in the history of the Cold War, which is virtually unknown in this country. And basically that centers around the role in American society and in the Cold War played by a man named Galen. His first name was Reinhard. His last name is spelled G-E-H-L-E-N. Now, Reinhard Galen was Hitler's most important intelligence officer during World War II. He was in charge of all intelligence for the Third Reich on the Eastern Front, and in that capacity was head of an organization called Fremde Heere Ost, which I've heard variously translated as Foreign Armies East. That's the most common translation, or occasionally Foreign Intelligence East. Now, this basically was, as I said, Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization during World War II, supplied the Reich with all of its intelligence on Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and it made very, very, very heavy use, and this is important for our purposes here, of the large anti-communist underground, which was basically left behind by the Tsarist elements after the Russian Revolution. There was still a lot of white Russians in Russia, and they were the Germans availed themselves of this white Russian underground to spy upon Russia. Now, the United States, at the end of the war, did not have an intelligence capability to speak of in Russia and Eastern Europe. So what they did was, 3 months after the war ended in Europe, a series of negotiations between Galen and the Americans concluded with Galen being flown into the United States in the uniform of a four-star general. Keep in mind, 3 months after the war ends in Europe, and basically, Galen and his entire Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, Fremde Heere Ost, with more than 4,000 SS and Gestapo veterans included in it, That organization was grafted onto the fledgling CIA and became its Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. That organization, again, Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization with SS and Gestapo agents galore, provided the United States with all of its intelligence, exclusive purveyor of intelligence on Russia and Eastern Europe, for more than a decade after the end of World War II, and the CIA continued to rely upon it very heavily after that. There were two other very important incarnations about the Galen organization to keep in mind. One was that coterminous with its role as the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, it became the official NATO intelligence organization, supplying NATO with up to 70% of its intelligence. And finally, it became the West German Intelligence Service, the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, and it is basically that to this day. Now, keep in mind that this organization provided us with all of our information on Russia and Eastern Europe, and keep in mind the White Russians and the reactionary Eastern Europeans who form an important element of this. In particular, a group which is known under a couple of names as NTS, the Russian abbreviation initials for Death to Tyrants, also known as the Solidarists. Now, not Solidarity, but Solidarists. Okay, and Nipper's going to tell you about a very important member of the Solidarists.
Indeed. And before I do this, I want to just go back one more time and touch on this, because this is something that Dave and I have talked about a great deal on KFJC, but it's still a lot of things that most people do not fully take into account. What we are talking about is within 3 months after the cessation of hostilities in Europe in World War II, the CIA had begun to literally graft the entire Nazi Eastern Front intelligence operation, including, as Dave said, fully trained Gestapo and SS members, and Reinhard Galen himself, one of Hitler's right-hand men, one of the men high in the councils of Hitler. Several of these people were literally sprung from the docket and from the holding cells at Nuremberg as war criminals, and were immediately snatched up and spirited off. Klaus Barbie was only the most recent example of one of these people who cut his deal with the CIA. But this is an entire organization, thousands strong, that was just literally grafted on to the United States intelligence services. So we're talking about not only just the management, but literally the manpower, maybe fully a quarter of our original manpower in the CIA were SS and Gestapo members. This is something you don't hear much about in your local civics classes. Anyway, back to the Solidarist organization, the basically the fifth column White Russian organization that the Galen group made such good use of for their intelligence activities, and quite a few of the Solidarists were literally czarists, and about as far to the right as you can possibly get. Anyway, this particular book is Were We Controlled by a man named Lincoln Lawrence. Although I believe he's writing under that name, he's actually a TV commentator and a magazine and broadcast media expert.
Yeah, that's a nom de plume. I don't know his real name. Nip, check publisher and copyright date, just for people's information.
Okay,
here.
Yes, indeed. This book was published by University Books Incorporated, and it was copyright 1967.
That's
okay.
Hardcover edition.
That's the hardcover edition, indeed. Okay, and he's talking about a man. I'm going to tell you the name now just because it's a tricky name, and you may have trouble remembering it. It's a man named George de Morenschild. And de Morenschild is spelled D-E, then capital M-O-R-E-N-S-C-H-I-L-D-T. Complicated name to spell, not that hard to remember once you've heard it. And somebody who figures prominently in the post-Russian life of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Before getting into the passage that Nip's talking about, I'll tell you just a couple of things about his background which aren't brought up in this section. George de Morenschild's father was the manager of the Baku oil fields in pre-revolutionary Russia. Those were owned by the Nobel family, the same Nobel as in dynamite and the Nobel Prizes. And, well, as I said, his father was the manager of the Baku oil fields for the Nobel family.
Indeed. Okay, now, one thing here I'm going to tell you is that Lincoln Lawrence in this book uses the word rumor, the rumor, as a keynote of referring. What he's basically referring to is the conspiracy, but he does not want to use the word conspiracy. This book was written in 67. He's talking about some things that he felt at the time were very sensitive and didn't want to get in the position of being a conspiracy buff type of situation. So he calls it the rumor. Anyway, he says, returning to our investigation of the rumor, we note that in the period from 1958 to 1959, a figure in the case decided to go to Switzerland and apparently to Germany. In Switzerland, he would, he stated, like to attend the Albert Schweitzer College in order to, among other things, quote, broaden my knowledge of German and live in a healthy atmosphere and good moral atmosphere. The man, under an influence, question mark, perhaps one that continued long after, who applied for a passport to Switzerland and Germany on September 21, 1959, was Lee Harvey Oswald. The world has a picture of Oswald as a Castro-Moscow sympathizer. That would lead us to accept his interest in Spanish and Russian. But little known to us was his interest, by his own statement, in German. The strong man that those close to Lee Oswald said was his best friend in those months before the assassination was George de Morenschild. This clever, sophisticated man, whose international background included friendships with Jackie Kennedy's father and mother, somehow found time to attune himself to the conversational sparkle of the Oswald household. George de Morenschild was born in Mazyar, Russia. His father was of German descent. George, unlike his brother, obscured his German heritage by a change of name from von Morenschild to de Morenschild. This fact was brought out by Assistant Counsel Albert Jenner in information gathered for the Warren Report. Jenner has since been condemned, along with the rest of the commission, for lack of zeal in digging out the real facts. Nevertheless, it is interesting to note that he scratched far enough below the surface to uncover the fact that in the 1940s, de Morenschild was involved in a business venture called Facts Incorporated, with a questionable partner, a, quote, distant cousin named Baron Meidel. Jenner suggested that Meidel was accused of being a German spy. De Morenschild admitted that people considered Meidel pro-Nazi. A particularly odd coincidence showing up as a result of Jenner's interrogation has to do with de Morenschild's father. He was seized by the communist regime for being outspoken, but decided later not to flee from Russia. To quote de Morenschild, his father, quote, heard from somebody that they, the communists, had become liberal, and so he, quote, stayed in Minsk. Lee Harvey Oswald was later to stay in Minsk. One brief quote from the exchange before the Warren Commission between Assistant Counsel Albert Jenner and de Morenschild. In connection with questioning about photographs that de Morenschild did or did not take of the Aransas Pass U.S. Coast Guard Station, presumably during World War II. Question, you went to Aransas Pass, and what did you do there? Answer, this is de Morenschild answering, well, what do they say we did? Question, did you take some photographs? Answer, possibly of each other. Question, you took no photographs of the Coast Guard Station there? Answer, I don't recall that. Question, did you make any sketches? Answer, yes, because I like to sketch. I sketched the dunes, the coastline, but not the Coast Guard Station. Who gives a damn about the Coast Guard Station in Aransas Pass? Question, I can tell you that that is what got you into trouble. Answer, is that so? Well, you were the first one to tell me about that. On the way back to the pass, some characters stopped the car and came out of the bushes, and they said, you are a German spy. Later in the testimony, de Morenschild admitted to knowing a little more about the, quote, characters. I have the impression they told me they were from the FBI, and they followed me all the way from New York. In the bright spotlight trained on the events in Dallas, the principals speak Spanish or Russian. The scenery is backdrops of Cuba, Moscow, and Minsk. In the shadows, the language and influence is German. In this one discrepancy lies the key to an understanding of the ways in which Lee Harvey Oswald may have been controlled. Now, de Morenschild is talking about a variety of things. The de Morenschild thing is vitally important in that one of the things that we're talking about is not only the fact that de Morenschild might or might not have been a German spy, but that George de Morenschild was a very a rich cosmopolitan man who moved in white Russian circles. Now, this is something that people do not talk about very much when they're talking about the Warren Commission, and some people have brought this up in their phone calls in the last couple of weeks. Namely, why did Lee Harvey Oswald, the supposed pro-Castro, pro-Moscow, you know, anti-U.S., sympathizer consort openly and continuously and virtually live with a group of white Russians who inhabited the Dallas area. Very politically conservative white Russians, many of whom had connections into the oil industry, into the defense and aeronautics industry, and things of that nature, especially the aeronautics industry, which we'll talk about, and the oil industry. These questions have not been answered. And George de Morenschild himself, regardless of whether he was or was not a German spy, it was somebody who himself also, all of his best friends were Tsarist sympathizers, white Russians, the European fascist underground that many cases they they were fascist sympathizers like the Vichy government, people of this sort. So this was Oswald's milieu. He was not hanging out with communists. He was not hanging out with Marxists. And he was certainly not hanging out with pro-Castro Cubans.
A couple of quick details. First of all, keep in mind that not only was Oswald palling around with all of these white Russian aristocrats and Eastern European aristocrats, but that he supposedly was a warehouse worker with an eighth grade education. And, you know, just about everybody he knew was either an Eastern European aristocrat or, as I've said before, a high roller in the aerospace or defense industry. Another interesting sideline to this affair of de Morenschild's father staying in Minsk. Now, Minsk is the capital of Bielorussia, and Oswald stayed there and performed activities unknown. Now, the Bielorussian Nazis were a major element of the fascist intelligence service, which was grafted on to the fledgling CIA along with the rest of the Galen organization. That group was headed by a guy named Franz Alfred Seeks. All of the Bielorussian Nazi collaborators are headed by a guy named Franz Alfred Seeks, who was an SS general, and one of the Nazi war criminals that Nip mentioned was actually sprung from the defendant's dock at Nuremberg to work in this case on the Special Forces Project. He was sprung from the defendant's dock at Nuremberg by then High U.S. High Commissioner of Germany, John J. McCloy. Now, John J. McCloy sits on the Warren Commission, along with Alan Dulles, who worked very closely with the Galen organization, and J. Edgar Hoover and some other people whose distance from the Third Reich is not as great as they might like to have you believe. Incidentally, the Bielorussian Nazis were the subject of a 60 Minutes show in April of 1982, and there's a book which is out now about the Bielorussian fascists called The Belarus Secret, B-E-L-A-R-U-S. It's copyrighted 1982 by Alfred Knopf, I believe, and is authored by a man named John Loftus, L-O-F-T-U-S. So if...
Who is, by the way, who was a Justice Department investigator. So this is a government investigation that he first ran into this stuff with.
And so if you want to find out about the Nazi sympathizers from Bielorussia, again, Minsk, the capital of Bielorussia, that's a good contemporary source to check out. Now, an interesting thing concerning the Solidarists is the fact that one of these Solidarists, one of these Eastern European fascists, who a member of, in all probability, the Galen organization, met Lee Harvey Oswald when he got back from the Soviet Union. Now, keep in mind, Oswald was supposedly a communist, pro-Russian, who had defected or had stated his intention to defect to the Soviet Union and giving them top-secret information about our radar nets and also the U-2. And keep that in mind. I'm going to read you a short section here. Again, this is from The Assassinations, edited by Scott, Hoke, and Stettler. And this is from an essay in that book. It's an anthology, by the way, a collection of essays. This is an essay called From Dallas to Watergate, The Longest Cover-Up. That is by another of the three editors, this Peter Dale Scott, last name S-C-O-T-T. Now, keep in mind, Oswald has supposedly defected to the Soviet Union and betrayed the United States, committed treason against the United States. Listen to what happens when he gets back to the U.S. Scott writes in From Dallas to Watergate. The desire of U.S. intelligence agencies to interview even casual visitors to the Soviet Union is well known. In June of 1962, Lee Harvey Oswald was a returning Marine defector who had once served at a CIA base and had told the U.S. Embassy in Moscow of his intention to pass information to Soviet officials. That in volume 18 of the 26 volumes of Warren Commission testimony and exhibits. For 2 years, he had worked in a sensitive Soviet factory and was now married to the niece of a colonel in Soviet intelligence. Yet the report tells us that the returning Oswald, keep in mind now, he's supposedly married to a KGB colonel's niece, okay? Yet the report tells us that the returning Oswalds were met in New York City, not by the FBI or CIA, but by, quote, Spaz T. Raikin, last name R-A-I-K-I-N, a representative of the Traveler's Aid Society. Okay. Now, more about Spaz T. Raikin here. Scott continues. The FBI interviews did not point out that Spaz T. Raikin was also the Secretary General of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, a small but vigorous group of right-wing, revanchist East Europeans in direct touch with the FBI and Army Intelligence, and also with the Galen Spy Organization in West Germany, the Kuomintang in Taiwan, the mother of Madame Nu, wife of President Diem of South Vietnam, right-wing Cubans like Oswald's DRE contact Carlos Bringier and other elements of a shadowy world anti-communist league. Okay, so we not only see that Spaz T. Rakin is affiliated with the Galen Spy Organization, but with a number of other organizations as well, including one that we've looked at in a couple of contexts in the past, and that is the DRE. Now, we've looked at the DRE in connection with a couple of elements in both the first and third shows.
That's right, and not only the DRE, the anti-Castro Cuban group that helped to set Oswald up for that radio broadcast that we played for you in the first episode, not only the Galen Organization, but this man, Spaz T. Rakin, the supposed man, member of Traveler's Aid, whose background was not mentioned by the FBI in their report for the Warren Commission, is the only person, and this again has to be stressed, the only person who showed up to interview Lee Harvey Oswald. So at this point, one just sort of has to wonder just a little teeny bit just exactly why they would nobody but Rakin would show up.
Yeah, a couple of quick points. Remember now, Carlos Bringuier was actually one of the people who interviewed Oswald and asked Oswald if he agreed with Castro's statement that Kennedy was a ruffian and a thief. And recall that the DRE was one of two sources named for a spurious charge that basically Cuban intelligence, Fidel Castro had assassinated President Kennedy, and this information came from two letters, both written on the same typewriter, one allegedly from a Cuban intelligence agent named Pedro Charles to Oswald, paying him for a job involving skilled sharpshooting, and the other warning about the Pedro Charles letter, supposedly from a fellow, I believe, whose name was Molina. But at any rate, the FBI investigated these charges and found out that both letters were written on the same typewriter, obviously blowing that out of the water. Now, the two sources for this information, one was an anti-Castro group, paramilitary group operated by Frank Sturgis, one of the Watergate burglars, and the other was the DRE that we talked about before.
Okay, and one more time, it's crucially important to make the point that not only was misinformation being handed out by these various right-wing groups, and well-timed and well-keyed misinformation in many cases, but that, as in the case of Spaz Rakin and a variety of other people that we've named and will continue to talk about, they were taking an active involvement in the life of Lee Harvey Oswald, as opposed to the fact that nobody could turn up a single actual Marxist, communist, socialist. I mean, they can't even find, a member of the liberal luncheon club who considered Lee Harvey Oswald to be a friend or an associate. So we're talking about swimming up upstream against an awfully strong historical tide when we're trying to pin Lee Harvey Oswald with being a Marxist.
Okay, now, going on to some other Nazi or fascist connections to the assassination, recall that one of the major facets of the controversy surrounding the JFK assassination concerns the investigation by former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. Now, Garrison indicted a number of different people in connection with the assassination, and the most important of the people Garrison indicted was a man named Clay Shaw. Now, we've talked about the circumstances surrounding the Garrison case and the information linking Clay Shaw to the patsy Lee Harvey Oswald. Recall that Oswald, as we demonstrated, did not kill Kennedy, certainly not alone, and in all probability, not at all. And so, if you want to know about the evidence and the information linking Clay Shaw, Lee Harvey Oswald, and David Ferry, ask us in the phone-in section because we've been over this before. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. Okay, now, to Clay Shaw. Clay Shaw was the main figure, according to Jim Garrison, in the assassination. And interestingly enough, even though his investigation was botched by a number of, I guess we could call it legal chicanery by a number of authorities we'll talk about later in the program, it's interesting that the jury in the Clay Shaw case concluded that there definitely had been a conspiracy to murder President Kennedy, but they could not find that Clay Shaw, beyond a reasonable doubt, had been involved, okay? Now, keep in mind Clay Shaw, because Clay Shaw was a member of the board of directors of an organization called the Centro Mondiale Commerciale, or World Trade Center in Italian. He also was president of another company called Permindex, P-E-R-M-I-N-D-E-X, and that was another corporate front for the Centro Mondiale Commerciale. Now, we're going to, if those names sound confusing, if you're trying to locate yourself, don't worry about it. We're about to go into just what that information was and its relevance to the discussion of the European and Nazi connections to the assassination. Now, the information I'm about to read you comes from a book called The Kennedy Conspiracy. It's authored by a man named Paris Flammonde, last name F-L-A-M-M-O-N-D-E, published in hardcover by the Meredith Press of New York in 1969, copyright 1969. It's one of the best books on the assassination. It is very, very rare, so you'll have a tough time finding it. Libraries would be a real good starting place for this one. Okay, of Clay Shaw and the Centro Mondiale Commerciale, keep in mind that's Italian for the World Trade Center, of which Clay Shaw was a member in New Orleans, and it's one of two fronts for a company called Permindex. Okay, of Centro Mondiale Commerciale, Permindex, and Clay Shaw, Paris Flamand writes as follows in the Kennedy Conspiracy. The Centro Mondiale Commerciale was founded in 1961. Spokesman asserted that it would function as an international commercial organization, that it would aid in the establishing of a permanent exposition, and generally assist concerns involved in trade. The staffing was expansive, the offices elaborate, and it gave all the appearance of being a rather grand operation. The board of directors was interestingly assorted. Several respected Italians were present, Christian Democrat Deputy Mario Ceravolo, C-E-R-A-V-O-L-O, and former Social Democrat Deputy Corrado Bonfantini, B-O-N-F-A-N-T-I-N-I. Listed as president was Carlo D'Amelio, D-A-M-E-L-I-O, lawyer and administrator for the former royal family's interests. The remainder of the board consisted of non-Italian names. Swiss Minister Ernest Feist, F-E-I-S-S-T, Swiss Professor Max Hagemann, H-A-G-E-M-A-N-N, brother Max Hagemann, owner of the editor, owner-editor of the newspaper National Zeitung, not to be confused with the neo-Nazi German National- und Soldatenzeitung, Hans Seligman Schürch, Basel banker, last name S-E-L-I-G-M-A-N-S-C-H-U-R-C-H, Professor Edgar Salin, S-A-L-I-N, president of the Faculty of Economics at the University of Basel, Dr. Enrico Mantello, brother of George Mandel, or Mantello, the power behind the Società Italo-Americana. That was one of the forerunners of the Centro. Ferenc Nagy, or I'm going to give you an alternate pronunciation of this name. This name you're going to see F-E-R-E-N-C, or sometimes with an E at the end, and then N-A-G-Y. Former Hungarian premier and erstwhile leader of the anti-communist Countrymen's Party, and president of Permindex, the head office of the CMC. This is an important figure. His name is spelled Ferenc Nagy. It is pronounced, actually, Nagy Ferenc. You actually sort of slur the two words. You put the first last name first and slur them together, I'm told, by a colleague who works at another station who speaks Hungarian. So you'll actually pronounce it Nagy Ferenc. You'll see it in print, F-E-R-E-N-C, last name N-A-G-Y. And he is, we're going to see here, a reactionary Hungarian. The next name, Prince Gutierrez de Spadafora, S-P-A-D-A-F-O-R-A, industrialist and landowner of oddly totalitarian turn of mind, related through his daughter-in-law to Adolf Hitler's notorious Minister of Finance, Hjalmar Schacht, S-C-H-A-C-H-T, tried as a war criminal at Nuremberg, and Clay L. Shaw of New Orleans. Now, continuing here. Now, what of these associates of the, quote, old-fashioned liberal of the Wilson-Roosevelt persuasion? That was a description of Clay Shaw by a friend of his. What kind of persons did they seem to be? Again, space precludes a full examination of each, or, for that matter, even a cursory individual analysis, but we certainly can look into the background and activities of a few. First, there is Giorgio Mantello, or Mandel, a Hungarian refugee, Austrian citizen functioning in Italy, Switzerland, and elsewhere, with financial transactions reaching throughout Europe, Africa, and America, who has, according to Paesa Serra, been condemned for his, quote, criminal activities, unquote, in Switzerland. This latter revelation was originally carried in the August 19, 1961 issue of the Basel newspaper A to Z, which featured a report about directors of government agencies saying, quote, in many articles, we have justly spoken of the criminal activities of Messrs. Nagy and Mantello. Mantello initiated a suit against the Swiss Journal, then abruptly abandoning it, causing A to Z to observe, quote, too bad, we would have heard some great things at the trial, unquote. Ferenc Nagy, again, that's not how his name is pronounced, but for simplicity's sake, I'm going to pronounce it that way here. Ferenc Nagy was closely associated with Mantello in his secret financial political maneuverings, in his highly secret financial and political maneuverings. When Mantello founded Permindex, the head office and other face of the Centro Mondiale Commerciale, Nagy became its president. He was the Nagy accused of, quote, criminal activities, unquote, along with Montello, and identified by Swiss newspapers as a, quote, dependent, unquote, of the CMC in Rome. Quote,